You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Okay, good morning. Let's go ahead and get started. First of all, welcome to the Brookings Institution. I'm Stephen Pfeiffer. I'm the director of the Arms Control and Nonproliferation Initiative, and it will be my pleasure to moderate today's panel discussion on U.S. missile defense developments, how far, how fast. Before introducing the panel, let me just make a couple of acknowledgments. First, I'd like to thank the Union of Concerned Scientists, which is co-sponsoring today's panel. And in particular, I'd like to thank Stephen Younger of the Union of Concerned Scientists for all of his help in making this happen. Let me also acknowledge the support of the Plowshares Fund and the Carnegie Corporation of New York for their support for the Arms Control and Nonproliferation Initiative. Now, over the last several years, when one talks about American missile defense, it seems to focus on two tracks. First, the question of ground-based mid-course defense for the United States, based on ground-based interceptors deployed in Alaska and California, intended to defend the United States against a limited ballistic missile attack. The second track is aimed at defending American allies and American forces forward deployed against ballistic missiles of less than intercontinental range, short range, medium range, and intermediate range. And the focus in the last several years of that program has been on the European phased adaptive approach, which the Obama administration announced in 2009, based on the Standard Missile 3. But there's also, as I think we'll hear about too, the Pentagon is looking at cooperative efforts both in the Persian Gulf and in Northeast Asia. There's a lot going on now on missile defense. It's believed that sometime this month the Defense Department will conduct a critical test of the ground-based interceptor, the Capability Enhanced 2 kill vehicle, an important test for a program that's had a difficult history the last several years. And also in Congress, you have suggestions about how missile defense might be reconfigured, some suggestions for a third site for ground-based interceptors on the East Coast, and then more recently, suggestions that the European phased adaptive approach, phase three, deployment in Poland should be accelerated in part as a punishment to Russia for its aggression against Ukraine. Today's panel is going to discuss the program status and a whole set of key questions regarding it, and I think we have an excellent group to explore these issues. I will not do long introductions because you have their bios in the program. But in the order that they'll speak, we have first Pepino Di Biasso. He's from the Office of Secretary of Defense. He is the Director of the Office of Missile Defense Policy. Our second speaker will be Phil Coyle. He's a Senior Science Fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. Then we'll have Christina Chaplin. She's a Director at the General Accountability Office. Laura Grego, who's a Senior Scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And finally, Dean Wilkinen, who's a physicist at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratories. After the panel makes the opening comments, we will open the floor up for your questions. So, Pippi, please start us off.
Thank you, Steve, and appreciate the opportunity to come and address the panel and the question on U.S. missile defense deployments, how far and how fast. Given that I just have a few minutes to sort of outline kind of current U.S. missile defense activities, sort of where we're at, how we got here, sort of where we're going. I'm going to go through it pretty quickly, hit the wave tops, and then there'll be, I gather, plenty of time for questions and answers, discussion and debate afterwards. Let me just start off with a couple of general observations about U.S. Policy on missile defenses. It's remained fairly consistent since the release of the 2010 Ballistic Missile Defense Review. Most of you are probably familiar with that. That document really has served as the kind of touchstone for sort of our activities, both with regard to homeland defense and with regard to regional missile defenses for the past, 4 years going on five, and has been reflected in all the key strategic guidance documents in the 2012 new defense strategic guidance document and more recently in the 2014 quadrennial defense review. So there's a connection here between our broader defense strategy and what we're trying to accomplish with missile defense. Just quickly, of course, the QDR highlighted three elements of U.S. defense strategy: protect the homeland, build security globally, and project power and win decisively. The relationship between missile defense and those major elements of missile defense is fairly straightforward. The homeland defense, the ground-based mid-course defense system, of which there are 30 interceptors, 26 at Greeley for it. Vandenberg are clearly focused on protecting the United States, its population, territory against limited attacks. That, in particular, is countries that we worry about who are, have significant developmental activities underway for long-range missile programs like North Korea and Iran. With regard to building security globally, we'll talk in a bit more detail, fairly active U.S. Approach, working with partners and friends in the three key regions that we worry about in Europe, in the Middle East, and the Gulf as a second region, and then in Northeast Asia, where, as I said, we've got pretty active sets of cooperation activities going on, really as part of our broader security partnerships and alliance commitments. And then lastly, the relationship between BMD and projecting power, again, from our perspective, is fairly straightforward. I mean, we're today continuing to provide substantial capabilities to U.S. combatant commanders, our war fighters in places like European Command, Central Command, and Pacific Command. Each of those combatant commanders now has substantial ground and maritime missile defense capabilities that contributes to our ability to protect ourselves, our forces, our bases, and maintain U.S. global presence in those regions, and in particular, help us start to deal with some of these newer challenges like anti-access and area denial strategies we see other countries pursuing. Given the consistency in our policy since at least 2010, our focus in the department really has been on the implementation of policy or of these programs. I mean, in the case of Homeland Defense or GMD, that means staying ahead of the threat relative to where we think North Korea and Iran could go here in the foreseeable future. It's an important phrase, staying ahead of threat, because it does shape and drive how we evolve the homeland's defense capabilities. In the context of regional defenses, it means putting special emphasis on cooperative relationships and burden sharing. It's missile defense, especially the regional defenses, Patriots, Standard missiles, Aegis, THAADs, are the classic sort of high-demand, low-density system. There's a lot of demand out there, both on the part of our friends and our partners and allies, as well as the warfighter, and not enough capacity. So emphasizing the mobility dimension of those defenses helps us accomplish the missions in those regions a little better in terms of our ability to swing capabilities from one theater to another, depending upon the particular crisis. The regional threat that we're coping with is, I won't dwell on that, happy to have that discussion, but thousands of certainly short, medium-range ballistic missiles, we're seeing the technologies continue to advance. Adversaries are going in the direction of mobility. They're using concealment and deception efforts to mask sort of their activities. They're developing capabilities to salvo launch, right, two, three, four, half dozen at a time. So these are all going to be challenges that certainly our regional missile defenses have to deal with. But the fundamental purpose of working with partners is so that at the end of the day, their capabilities, our capabilities, working together in an integrated or interoperable fashion, produce a capability that would be much better than it had we just gone this alone or we'd done it in a bilateral context. Just quickly, the wave tops on a little deeper dive on Homeland Defense. You're all familiar with the Secretary's decision back in March of last year to augment U.S. homeland defenses in large part because of some of the trends we were seeing. The TD2 had just completed the 12-year developmental cycle successfully, starting with the first launch of the TD1 back in the summer of 98 and concluding with the successful three-stage missile or space launch vehicle, whatever it was that they launched back in December of 2012. Some of the activities we've started to see, you've heard administration officials talk about this North Korean rogue mobile missile, the KN-08. So as a result of those factors coming together, one, and two, recognizing the challenge, the time it takes to build, develop, and test missile defenses, the Secretary concluded it was the right time to begin to augment Homeland Defense. A couple of quick decisions. It involved the deployment of a second TPY-2 radar in Japan, very critical radar. This is one that not only will help the Japanese in their own regional defense, but contributes to U.S. homeland defense. The Secretary talked about deploying or funding 14 additional ground-based interceptors that bring the current total from 30 to 44. Related to that, as you know, MDA, I think Steve mentioned, has this important test coming up here in the not-too-distant future of a redesigned kill vehicle, the CE-2. So this will be obviously an important test. It follows a successful test of the CE-2 non-intercept, I believe they did at the beginning of the year, to try to determine if they had been able to address some of the problems associated with that, as I understand it, some of the vibration in the kill vehicle. And I guess Admiral Searing, the director of MDA, feels confident that they've sort of at least demonstrated their ability to dampen some of that vibration. The Secretary, at the time of the March decision last year, also initiated terminologies varied a little bit, but a new design for a kill vehicle, a common kill vehicle, EKV redesign. Even today, I'm not quite sure the terminology floats back and forth a little bit, but it is a recognition that the United States really does need to sort of get on with the next generation of kill vehicle, regardless of sort of where we end up with the current GBI kill vehicle systems, which were deployed, you know, in a fairly accelerated fashion a number of years ago. There's a recognition of the need to move on to the second generation of kill vehicle. This is part of sort of sensible, prudent spiral development. And so there'll be – that program is underway. There's funding for it at this point. In addition, Congress has directed the Missile Defense Agency to go explore the possibility of a third site in the United States, sometimes referred to as an East Coast site, but the sites that have been identified actually go beyond the East Coast. And the reason that drove Congress to do that is a view that this third site would need to be would help in dealing in the future with a long-range Iranian ballistic missile to the East Coast. The administration position is it's doing the site surveys, it's conducting the environmental impact statements, but it's made no decision to proceed with the deployment. In fact, senior officials have said the next dollar the department should be spending on missile defenses ought to be to getting the GBI healthy, sustainability, reliability, improving the kill vehicle, and looking at sensors, as that's where more bang for the buck is likely to be found. Quickly turning to regional defenses, again, sort of three major areas where there's an awful lot of activity. I'll try to step through those fairly quickly, but if you go back to the BMDR, we outlined approach for regional missile defense and said, look, we have to recognize that each of the regions of concern, Europe, the Middle East and Gulf, and Northeast Asia, have a different set of variables, just different geopolitical region, different threats, different allies, different partners, different levels of capacity that friends or partners can contribute, and so that we would have to tailor these approaches in our missile defense cooperation to each of these three regions. With regard to EPAA, again, most of you are familiar, three phases. It did have four at one point. I won't talk about the discussion on that right now, but at least with regard to phase one is underway, radar in Turkey, Aegis ship in the Med with SM-3 interceptors. NATO has worked through issues like command and control, so there's actually a NATO role in how we might transfer authority of that capability between EUCOM and SACEUR as it transitions between sort of U.S. command and a European command. We've worked through these all the details, rules of engagement, and so forth. Phase two and three, an Aegis ashore in 15 and one in 18 in Poland, one in Romania, one in Poland, are on track, well supported by the administration. Funding is there quickly. There's been some discussion about accelerating the phase three of the system that we've interacted a fair bit with our European allies. None of them have said that they think that is a useful measure to do right now. There are a wide range of activities that the administration, the department have underway with regard to responding to Russia, much of which has sort of been in the press here in the last 12 hours. So at this point, I mean, the Department of Defense certainly doesn't see any reason to accelerate phase three, probably not a good use of the money, and the question becomes exactly what would that system be used for in the context of a sort of a Russian regional conflict. Asia-Pacific, just quickly, a fair bit of interaction with the Japanese who are helping us co-develop the follow-on SM-328 missile, which will actually be part of EPAA, as well as our own, contribute to U.S. maritime capabilities. The Japanese have a very substantial missile defense layered program with PAC-3s and SM-3s on their ships. We're working fairly closely with both the Australians and the South Koreans to explore whether there are opportunities there. Most of that discussion is sort of in the consultative stage. But again, the same goal in that region is to integrate the missile defenses that the U.S. has in those regions with those of our partners to the extent that that's politically doable. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't, because of the nature of the relationships in those regions, so that at the end of the day, there's a more effective, seamless set of regional capabilities. And lastly is sort of the Middle East and Gulf. Very strong programs of missile defense cooperation with the government of Israel, obviously almost across the board from dealing with short-range artillery all the way through sort of their concerns with longer-range, you know, medium-range ballistic missiles coming out of places like Iran. Very active approach underway with the Gulf cooperation countries. The U.S. has been spending a lot of time and effort working with its partners in that region, who are actually acquiring rather advanced U.S. missile defense systems, Patriot PAC-3s and THAADs and so forth, the Emiratis and the KSA and so forth. Again, the effort there is to sort of work first in a bilateral manner with each of the GCC states who are interested, and then over time to try to get the Gulf states to work in a more collaborative fashion, because as we build that regional architecture in terms of air and integrated air and missile defense, will tend to reduce the seams and gaps that result when you're only doing bilateral relationships. It's a political challenge because those of you who are familiar with the Gulf, you know, there's tensions that exist amongst those countries, and so the politics tend to be the most significant obstacle to that, but we're continuing to push pretty hard. And so with that kind of quick one over the world, I'll stop there.
Thanks for including me in this event, Stephen, thank you. Thanks for including me in this event, and thank you all for coming. I'm going to restrict my comments to the ground-based system. That's the one that deserves your attention most. There's an old saying often applied to government, why is it that there is never enough time to do it right, but there's always enough time to do it over? That saying applies to the ground-based mid-course system. Over time, the performance of this system has been getting worse, not better. Since 1999, there have been 16 flight intercept tests, 8 of those successful, 50%. Not bad, but not good enough. Since post-2002, there have been 9 flight intercept tests, and 3 of those were successful, so 33%. And since December 2008, there have been 4 flight intercept tests, and only 1 successful, 25%. So the performance of the GMD system in these flight intercept tests has been getting worse with the passage of time when it ought to be getting better. I hope the next test is successful. If it is, it will be the first success in 5.5 years, which is way too long. And I'm sure that the Missile Defense Agency is doing everything they can to have a successful test. But if it is successful, what will that tell us? In its only 2 flight intercept tests so far, the Capability 2 EKV failed both times. So if the next test is successful, the batting average for CE2 will be 1 for 3. Not bad for baseball, but not good enough to justify putting more of those interceptors in the ground, especially when those interceptors have no demonstrated capability to do target discrimination, that is, to discriminate real, possibly stealthy, reentry vehicles, enemy reentry vehicles, from space debris, missile junk, chaff, decoys, and perhaps in the presence of radar jamming. That's why the National Academy recommended the design of a new, bigger, and more capable CUEL vehicle. And the Director of Operational Test and Evaluation has also recommended that a new design be considered. So why should we deploy more of these CE2s now that MDA has decided to redesign the CUEL vehicle? Well, we shouldn't deploy more of these flawed interceptors. And MDA should redesign the CUEL vehicle. The trouble is that MDA hasn't bitten the bullet yet and decided to redesign the GMD interceptors as the National Academy recommended. Instead, MDA is making fixes on the margins on the existing EKV rather than designing a truly improved interceptor as the Academy recommended. So do we need an East Coast site? Not only do we not need an East Coast site, we don't have the interceptors and sensors required for an East Coast site to be viable. The reason the National Academy recommended an East Coast site was to open up the battle space and provide more time for target discrimination against incoming missiles from Iran. An East Coast site doesn't help much with North Korea. But the idea here requires what they called a shoot-look-shoot strategy, namely shooting several times at the same target and looking at it between shots to see if it has been destroyed. But all this takes time and can't be done with the existing interceptors or sensors. And unfortunately, without the proper interceptors and sensors, including satellites and high-altitude UAVs, which we don't have, shoot-look-shoot is a fantasy without the equipment, the rest of the architecture that would be required, and so it would be just a waste of money. Could sit there as a monument for many years waiting for these other pieces of the architecture to catch up, but that's what it would be. Should we accelerate the European phased adaptive approach in Poland? No, I don't think we should. The EPAA is aimed at Iran, not Russia. Russia already hates the EPA because it involves new military bases in former Soviet territories close to Russia. So accelerating the EPAA might make Russia hate it even more, but I don't think much. Accelerating the EPAA would have no real impact on Russia. However, Iran might misunderstand and see the acceleration as a threat to Iran, and an expression by the U.S. that it does not intend to honor the ongoing talks that are working to reduce the scope of Iran's nuclear program to clearly peaceful civil power purposes. It also could make Russia a less willing partner in these talks with Iran than Russia has been, and this would be a most unfortunate outcome from sword rattling meant to somehow punish Russia for the Ukraine. I look forward to your questions.
Thank you. Christina? Hello. The GAO was asked to look at a number of issues related to missile defense, including EPAA and GMD this year, and we issued about 5 reports this spring that I've been asked to talk briefly about. Before I do, I just would like to remind everybody we are an independent audit organization. We don't advocate policy. We focus more on the how things are being done, and we do our work at the request of Congress. But we have been in missile defense for over a decade, and we have a lot of things to say about it. For GMD this year, the thing we stressed the most was the ongoing issue of concurrency, what we call concurrency, in how they acquire the GMD system. That's the overlapping of key acquisition activities, design with production. And some degree of concurrency is okay in major weapons programs. You do have to buy some long lead items ahead of certain activities. But the degree to which concurrency was present in GMD was extreme, and it had very severe consequences that we're still wrestling with today. Over $30 billion have been invested in GMD, and we're essentially still in the design phase. We're still producing prototypes. We've had to exert $1.3 billion just to recover from the last flight test failures. We've already discussed the issue of vibration and the CE2 today. Those are the kinds of things you want to shake out early in weapons development. You want to do that early so that you don't get caught in a production cycle and find you have an issue that's going to require you to go back in and fix all the interceptors. So that's where GAO has been with GMDA. That's where we were again this year. We brought it into all our work. We'll be examining the extent to which concurrency is still present in the efforts going forward for redesign. For EPAA, we continue to hammer the need this year for robust management tools for EPAA. DoD's views this as a policy and the need to be flexible and is a little resistant to the tools that we're recommending that be imposed on EPAA. But in our view, it's a very complex set of acquisitions. The success of EPAA depends highly on the integration of a lot of systems. And for those to work, you do need some tools in place to make it happen, one being a master integration schedule, for example. They do have a good integration plan, and they have a very robust test plan for EPAA, but we would like to see activities brought together with timelines so that we know to really pinpoint the progress we're making and what things we're still waiting for EPAA, because our reports did point out a number of delays for key capabilities related to integration, particularly with, like, upgrades for the C2BMC battle management component of it. We'd also like to see updated cost estimates for EPAA. It was good that DoD produced a cost estimate. It's a few years old now. We don't have phase four. You know, it might be a good idea to update that. And in one of our reports, we stressed the need for the cost estimates for individual components to be very complete, particularly with ONS costs for components like Aegis Ashore. They represent billions of dollars, so it's important that the Congress know really what we're paying for these activities. We also stressed in our reports more robust implementation planning. When the first phase was rolled out, there were a lot of good things that happened, but there were some issues that weren't really anticipated in advance. Housing wasn't complete, sharing the data with allies, things of that nature. Another tool we'd like to see in place that's fairly robust is performance assessments, and they haven't been as robust as we've thought they should be so far. There's also an issue related to that with the deletion of important tests for EPAA. Just to give you an idea, Aegis Ashore went from 7 planned tests to 2 planned tests. The SM-31B went from 11 planned intercepts to 7. So the less testing you do, the less knowledge you have, and you don't want to find yourself rolling out systems without knowing fully that they can work as intended. The third theme we've had in all our reports this spring that we continue to have almost every year is the flexibility that's afforded MDA does cause the issues. They don't have to follow the same rules as other weapon systems. They're deferred from entering into the formal acquisition process. So things like independent cost estimates aren't required of all the major systems for MDAA. Analyses of alternatives, requirement setting process is not the same as it is for the other weapon systems. Cost reporting is not the same. And together, this kind of flexibility, while it enables MDA to meet some very tight deadlines, it does create and contribute to high-risk acquisition strategies, a lack of transparency, and difficulty measuring progress in cost, schedule, and performance. And while the data has improved in recent years on those fronts, it still takes a very knowledgeable team, people who've been involved in this work for 10 years perhaps, to be able to read through the lines and really assess the progress MDA has made and where the cost growth has been. And as I mentioned earlier, a compounding problem for MDA is the external pressures placed on them. So the very tight deadline set for GMD in the very beginning almost gave them no choice. They did have to follow a high-risk strategy if they wanted to meet that deadline. They did have to overlap activities. But it's just like Phil said, you know, you're trading time. You're going to have to pay that anyways later on. And we see that with the EPAA. We saw that deadlines were set for EPAA without really knowing the full scope of work that was needed to execute that. So we would like to see more flexibility for when the phases are due and when systems are delivered, just so that we assure that we're getting what we paid for and things can work as intended. So this concludes my talk for now.
Thanks so much for inviting me and organizing this event, and I appreciate all the service of my fellow panel members. If you don't already know, Union of Concerned Scientists, we're a non-governmental, nonpartisan organization, and we aim to bring to bear the perspective of a well-informed citizen based on rigorous technical analysis. We actually do have an advocacy mission, so I'm going to amplify some of Christina's comments from and I'll go ahead and advocate. UCS has long been skeptical about how the possible benefits of national missile defense are weighed against its risks and its costs. And I'm going to focus today again about how the benefits are shaping up and why. Where we are today is largely a result of setting a fairly risky course in 2002 when the Bush presidential directive instructed the Pentagon to produce an initial strategic missile defense capability by 2004 to defend against a perceived imminent missile threat. This was a politically based timeline, not technically based. That is, it wasn't set by the expected level of technical difficulty of the task. To meet this deadline, the administration, with the cooperation of Congress, eliminated treaty restraints, ratcheted up spending, and set up a special system for research and development with lowered oversight and accountability. Because of the political climate at that time, it was difficult to challenge this exceptional status missile defense was given. And while the 2010 Ballistic Missile Defense Review promised to slow down this accelerated pace and to improve oversight, progress has proved mixed. And to date, no one has really mounted a serious challenge to this exceptional status that missile defense has been granted. While the Bush administration might have considered bypassing that oversight process crucial to the goal of getting something in the ground quickly, it has had real and serious consequences, as my fellow panelists have discussed already. And again, focusing on the exoatmospheric kill vehicle development program, I think is not a one-off problem. It's symptomatic of the whole approach. Because of those short timelines, the GMD's interceptors were built out of existing technology without a real development cycle. The early CE-1 kill vehicles, which were essentially developmental versions, were deployed at a steady pace starting in 2004. However, the first flight test, not intercept test, of a CE-1 kill vehicle wasn't until December 2005, after the system had already been fielded, essentially, with the first intercept test scheduled for a year later. Now, although there was success in that program early, the Missile Defense Agency recognized they needed to refurbish those CE-1 interceptors, and the GAO estimated that that would cost between $14 and $24 million per GBI of those already fielded interceptors. However, one of those CE-1 kill vehicle-equipped interceptors failed its test last summer, and the test review board found several issues of concern with the design of the kill vehicle, which appear to affect both the CE-1 and the CE-2 kill vehicles. And the CE-2 has had sort of a similar story, with interceptors being fielded without having actually been tested first. After a lengthy investigation, it seems that the Missile Defense Agency believes it's identified the core problem. And as Phil discussed, this has paved the way for a test this summer to see if that has actually worked. As Christina mentioned, the GAO has warned over and over about the concurrency of the system compromising its integrity and increasing the technical risk. At present, as she mentioned, the price tag to fix the CE-2 EKVs that have already been produced stands at $1.3 billion. You can see that the Missile Defense Agency hasn't been required to pursue independent cost estimates and has struggled to provide adequate information to Congress for them to be able to provide effective oversight. But despite these many problems, Congress and taxpayers are being asked to fund the purchase of 14 additional GBIs to counter the perceived maturation of the North Korean threat. Well, I am sympathetic to the need to respond to outward threats. This doesn't seem to be any different than the way things have been going. Buying 14 more interceptors that don't work very well doesn't present an additional capability. I don't think it's a wise choice. Although one of the six policy priorities of the Ballistic Missile Defense Review is before new capabilities are deployed, they must undergo testing that enables assessment under realistic operational conditions. The system hasn't been tested under a range of lighting conditions. It's never been tested against an ICBM range target or a warhead that's tumbling, nor in the presence of extensive launch debris. And the kill vehicle is in the process of a complete redesign. This isn't fly before you buy. The other point I wanted to draw your attention to is that the dearth of oversight and accountability also makes a missile defense system more vulnerable to being changed on the fly by, for example, entrepreneurial Congress members who find technical or political deficiencies of the system. It's not to say that Congress couldn't be a cradle of great ideas, but those ideas do need to be evaluated in a rigorous way. Nor, as Christina mentioned, normal major military programs are required to perform things like an analysis of alternatives to evaluate the benefits and risks of these ideas, as well as to pursue independent cost estimates. Missile defense is exceptional, and it doesn't have to do that necessarily. So one example of this working this way is the effort to move forward the idea of an East Coast missile defense site. The Missile Defense Agency didn't ask for it, and it didn't prioritize an additional site, but has been commanded by Congress to undertake preparatory work for such a site. So there wasn't a process or a rigorous debate about why we should consider funding a new site that would cost billions of dollars to build and equip and would most certainly take funds away from getting the existing system to meet its delayed milestones. That the East Coast site has any traction at all is a symptom of how badly the oversight and accountability has been working. And I would argue that the exceptional status and low bar of accountability also allows a missile defense system to be proposed as a way to work a thorny foreign policy problem like the Ukraine. For the suggestion for a return to the Bush plan to put land-based GBIs in Europe or the acceleration of the scheduled deployment of the Aegis Ashore site in Poland is sort of symptomatic of the same thing. It's been over a decade of working under this special status, and it's not working well. I would argue that the Missile Defense Agency should be held more accountable to Congress in the ways that the other major Pentagon programs are, and that Congress should exercise its stewardship responsibilities thoughtfully and rigorously, and that our job as U.S. citizens and those of you who are policymakers should take a hard look at the current strategic missile defense program and insist on making informed decisions about what's worth keeping and what's not productive for our interests. And that's the conclusion of my remarks. Thanks.
Thank you, Steve, and thanks to Brookings for hosting this event. I will keep my remarks very short because most of the other panel members have touched on things I was going to say. Let me start by saying I think one of the problems with the GMD system, the Homeland Missile Defense System, is that we have tended to exaggerate the ICBM threat to this country for a long time. If I go back to the Rumsfeld Commission report, the conclusion was that within 5 years of a decision to do so, states like North Korea or Iran could have ICBMs. Well, that was 16 years ago. So either you conclude that North Korea did not have an intent to build ICBMs, or it's more difficult than people were led to believe. I think it's the latter. I think North Korea has been trying to build a long-range missile for some time. So to some extent, I think that mentality still is infecting the current debate. On the other hand, there are uncertainties about how soon the threat may materialize, and people come down in different places as to how risk-averse or how risk-acceptant they want to be with respect to strategic surprise. Protecting the homeland is obviously a completely legitimate objective. Should be probably our top priority. And I think today the administration seems to be moving in a direction where that is the top priority. They're really putting a tremendous amount of effort into trying to fix some of the problems with the Homeland Missile Defense System. As Phil and others have pointed out, the test record has been rather abysmal with the GMD system. That's for the simple reason that it's a prototype system. It was, as Laura just said, it was rushed into the field for political reasons. It is unfortunate in retrospect that this system was not redesigned 8 years ago, 6 years ago. But there were other priorities. I think when Obama came into office, there was a strong emphasis on redesigning the European missile defense architecture from the so-called third site, what was called the third site at that time, to now what became the EPAA. So for whatever reason, GMD languished, and we've seen, at least on the test range, the results of continuing to spiral improve a prototype, which is a hard thing to do. So fortunately, we're in the position now where we're trying to redesign, or the MDA and the Defense Department is committed to a redesign of the kill vehicle, which is probably long overdue. Whether we have the budget to do that and to fix any problems that are currently exist with the CE-1 and CE-2 variants of the ground-based interceptor remains to be seen. There are tremendous budget pressures on the Missile Defense Agency, as with the whole department in general. But in my view, the technology is inherently good. Look at the test record of the other hit-to-kill system. THAAD is 11 for 11. THAAD went through an abysmal period. The program was almost canceled in the late 90s. I think it was 0 for 6 or 1 for 6, something like that. Zero. So it was pretty bad. They almost canceled the whole program. They redesigned the system, and now it's 11 for 11. SM-3 is 28 for 32, 34, something like that. So these systems have been working quite well. So in my view, there's nothing wrong with the inherent technology of the hit-to-kill systems. Unlike Phil, I think the EKV does have some ability to handle countermeasures. I guess one of the big questions is whether this decision to deploy 14 more, remember that occurred in the midst of some fairly provocative acts by North Korea. If we leave North Korea out of the picture, it would be preferred to have the 14 be the redesigned as opposed to CE-2s. But in fact, North Korea was very much front and center in the picture, and I think the decision was made. I can't speak for those that made the decision, but my assumption is they did not want to accept any risk of surprise that, in fact, North Korea might be able to move faster than other people thought. And so they chose to deploy 14 of the existing system. That happened to be the CE-2. And as Phil has just mentioned, we haven't had a lot of success with that. We'll see what happens in the next month or so when the next test occurs. In my view, whether the test is successful or not is in part immaterial. We need to redesign that kill vehicle, get on with a Block 2, a second generation, whatever you want to call it, as soon as possible. And my hope is that that'll occur soon. Let me leave it at that. I won't talk about the other regional missile defense issues. We'll save more time for Q&A.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I think we've brought out a number of questions, a number of aspects of the missile defense programs, both the continental defense for the United States and the ground-based interceptor, but also regarding things like the SM-3 and regional defense. So let me at this point open up the floor to questions. My request would be is that you state your name and affiliation. Keep commentary short, and at the end, please have something that looks like a question mark. So, up here.
Hi, Rachel Oswald, Global Security Newswire. This question is for Mr. DeBasio. could you state what the Pentagon's response will be to an unsuccessful intercept test of the GBI system this month? Will you cancel the 14 ordered missiles, or will you proceed with the procurement plan?
Well, first of all, we're going to await the outcome of the test before we decide exactly what the next set of decisions will be taken. So I won't speculate if it fails. But a couple of observations. MDA has done a lot of good work over the past year, confident that it has identified those challenges with the CE-2. We'll see, right? The test is coming up here shortly. I think I would rephrase the question, put it in the context of, look, the mission is to protect the United States from what by all means would be some kind of catastrophic attack. So the notion that because we have a particular test failure, we would walk away from that mission is, of course, ridiculous. There is no higher priority that the administration or the department can do than take the measures to address sort of the challenges that if we don't face them today, that we are likely to face in the coming years. And so so we'll see what the test brings, but there is a recognition, again, as I made, I think, some commentators on the panel have made this point as well, as did I, that the decision to move forward with the next generation kill vehicle, the redesigned kill vehicle, is aimed at continuing to do the technology development work that leads to a more effective, reliable kill vehicle to support the mission of Homeland Defense. So we'll await the outcome of the test. We'll see, you know, I mean, there could be a lot of variables associated with in terms of its performance, whether it results in the department vectoring towards doing more with CE2 or moving in a direction more aggressively with the EKV redesign.
Pepe, if I could follow up with a follow-up question. I think Dean made the point that if you did not have a North Korea factor in the game, that it might make sense basically to devote more of the effort to redesigning the kill vehicle as opposed to going forward and trying to fix the problems in the CE2. But does the administration, again, I think your comment suggests that there still is a concern that the North Koreans could be closer than we think. What is the estimate for when North Korea might obtain an ICBM capability?
I'd make a couple of observations with regard to sort of North Korean long-range missile threat. Dean rightly pointed out that the Rumsfeld Commission back in 98 said that we could see something within 5 years, and it took more than 5 years. But, in fact, we saw a couple of interesting things, starting with the TD-1 launch back in July or August of 1998, concluding with the successful TD-2 launch in December of 2012, where we saw multiple staging of a rocket, where we saw a payload inserted into space, demonstrated a pretty substantial knowledge in terms of long-range missile, whatever, you know, we can debate whether it's a space launch vehicle or ICBM, but those of you out there who've been in the missile business, either on the offense or defense side, clearly understand that space launch vehicles are generally feeders into ICBM programs. In fact, the Russian SLV program was a feeder into their ICBM program, as it was for the U.S. back in the 50s. So the technologies are fairly common. So, I mean, they concluded essentially a 12-year RDT&E cycle with the TD-2. So now we see at least some activity with this KN-08 missile. It, you know, very debatable. There will be arguments about, you know, its reliability, is it real, and so forth. But for the department and for the administration, I mean, we have to treat these matters as though, right, they will eventually materialize. There is enough evidence out there to suggest that, yes, we need to take the measures now to ensure that we have a defense before that threat arrives rather than after. In fact, we're all here today discussing the issue of how difficult it is to build missile defenses and how long it takes to build effective missile defenses. So all the more reason to make sure that we're undertaking the decisions now, hopefully years in advance of actually seeing an operational system.
Andrea Shalal with Reuters. Just following along that line of questioning, you know, if there was a decision to, as you said, sort of push forward more aggressively on the EKV redesign, depending on what the outcome is of the test, what is your estimate for the quickest that new vehicle could be available? I've heard sort of varying estimates from the different companies. And I also wanted to ask all of you, actually, whether there's any need for accountability on the failures and the problems with this program. I mean, there have been private contractors involved. There have been, you know, decisions by the government in terms of how to proceed on these programs. I mean, to what extent is all this, you know, money that's been spent on things that don't work as well as they should, you know, to what extent is there some sense of or need for accountability?
Yes, just on the issue of EKV redesign and whether shorter timelines to do that, I just you'd have to ask that question of Admiral Searing of MDA. I couldn't tell you that as a policy official.
Can we address the accountability question?
I'll address it. Since we're the Government Accountability Office, I do like to see people held accountable, but I just think in this case there could be difficulties because whose fault really is it? Is it the government's fault for putting deadlines that were kind of impossible to meet and to impose changing demands on a contractor, or is it the contractor's fault? And I know MDA has struggled with that itself through the years when some of the test failures were due to quality issues. Holding contractors accountable for them. MDA had to kind of change the way it approached that and tried to hold contractors more accountable. But generally, I don't see a whole lot of accountability, and I think it's very difficult to impose.
Well, I would just, on the accountability issue, I would just say that we seem to be living in a time when there is very little tolerance for test failures. If we go back to the 1950s, some of our most advanced programs at the time were failing right and left, trying to put satellites in orbit, even getting a booster big enough to do so. And you kind of wonder what would the reaction to both the public and Congress be if we had a string of failures like we had with the Redstone and the Atlas missiles and all that. We'd be canceling these programs right and left. We probably wouldn't have satellites in orbit today. So I would like to see a little greater tolerance for some of these test failures. You learn a tremendous amount. You learn more from test failures than you do from successes in a way. You should be pushing the envelope of these systems to really find out what their limits are, sensor limits, divert limits, reliability, whatever. So I am not as troubled by failures as I think a lot of people, at least in the R&D phase. By the time you get to deployment, you should have shaken that stuff down. And that's the problem with the GMD system, unlike the others. There is accountability in the sense that contractors almost lose these contracts. Lockheed Martin went through that with THAAD. They almost lost the contract, which is billions of dollars. And when that kind of thing occurs, they sit up and take notice. They get very serious about, in that case, redesigning the system in conjunction with MDA. So this problem, the lack of accountability is not as great a concern to me, I think, as to some others.
Just a short comment. I think one of the problems is that we elide the difference between a developmental program and an operational capability. And some of these failures are the kinds of things that you expect in a developmental program. But if we talk about the system as an actual defense, actual capability, which it frequently is, then you see you see a failure of an operational capability, which it really isn't.
Thank you, Jean-François Paquetet. I'm a visiting fellow in the CSIS. My question would be about mid-course discrimination, because it has been highlighted by a few past reports, I think the National Academy of Science, as a key weakness of the system. And it's about all the U.S. interceptors, the ability to choose between the warhead and the decoys or the debris. So my question to all the panelists would be, how concerned are you about this issue of mid-course discrimination? How hard, in your view, is the U.S. government trying to solve the issue? And how close is it to solving the issue? Thank you.
I'm very concerned about this problem of mid-course discrimination. Everybody who has looked at this problem has said that you can't have an effective mid-course missile defense system without the ability to discriminate the real target from other objects that are in the cloud near it. The Defense Science Board said, if the defense should ever find itself in a situation where it's shooting at missile junk and space debris, we're in trouble because we don't have enough interceptors to be able to go after each one of those objects. So it's a very serious problem. We've got 20 CE-1s in the ground that have no demonstrated capability to do that. We have 10 CE-2s and a proposal for 14 more that have no demonstrated capability to do that. So I'm very concerned.
On the discrimination issue, countermeasures and discrimination is the one of the big challenges for mid-course missile defense. But the way these conversations usually go is people treat it as though it's a binary issue. You can discriminate, you can't discriminate. There are dozens of different types of countermeasures. Some of them are easy to deal with. Some of them are much more difficult. The ones that are difficult, sometimes you can discriminate them with 10, 20% probability. Not 100, but it's not zero. So in my view, this debate is much more complex, and it's hard to give a simple answer. I think MDA is working this problem fairly hard. But if I was to come up with a simple answer that I think is true, I'd make the following statement. There is no countermeasure for which I cannot design an effective mid-course defense. And there is no mid-course defense architecture for which I cannot design a countermeasure. Both those statements are true. So it depends on who has the last move. It depends on the technical sophistication of each side. It depends on the intelligence you have about the countermeasure they have about the effectiveness of your radars, your optical systems, et cetera. And so most public debates about this issue make it sound like you can or you can't. I think it's much more complex, and I think the problem's being worked. And I have reasonable confidence that the first generation ICBMs will see the GMD system, once it's properly designed, will be able to handle the countermeasures that may accompany those ICBMs.
James Kiesling, interested private citizen with background in the topic. Dean, you sat on the National Research Council BPAC panel. Phil, you and others spent time looking at the questions raised by that panel. Essentially, one of the major findings from the Defense Science Board and the National Research Council was basically the identification that MDA appeared to be the gang that can't shoot straight. Fundamentally, the shortfalls in the intellectual capacity of the engineering team and the science team were felt to essentially preclude an expectation of being able to solve the various problems that have been identified. What I would just simply say as a concerned private citizen, the public release information does not lead confidence that MDA has appropriately identified root causes of their failures, for example. So the basic question I have for the panel is, what policy role about addressing this intellectual capacity to, you know, do this very difficult problem? You know, BMD has been compared as harder than the Manhattan Project. What are we doing to redress this intellectual capacity issue and oversight?
I've said in writing in an article that I think the Missile Defense Agency needs to get really good scientists on its staff, that is an important priority for government in general, for government to be a good buyer, a knowledgeable buyer. It needs to have good technical capability itself in order to know whether what the contractor is proposing to do makes sense or not. For example, the Missile Defense Agency was going full speed ahead on a satellite system, and it wasn't until the National Academy did their study and pointed out that the orbits were in the wrong place and that this, as a result, that satellite system wouldn't work, that the system was canceled. You shouldn't have to do a big National Academy study every single time you're looking at various technical options, you ought to have the capability within the Missile Defense Agency to know, hey, look, that thing's been designed so that the orbit is in the wrong place. It's not going to work. So I think it's an important issue, and I've written so publicly.
Maybe just one other observation to Jim's. I mean, there are sort of checks and balances in the department as it relates to missile defense, right? We've seen programs that weren't performing, behind schedule, weren't likely to meet some, you know, operational concept. The department canceled the MKV multiple kill vehicle program. It's all around the 09, 2010. The kinetic energy interceptor, the KEI, the ABL, maybe longer than some might have hoped. But, you know, when you bring together the different organizations within the Pentagon, and there are many who are scrutinizing MDA, right? I mean, I think at the end of the day, you end up with some type of checks and balances on these programs. That PTSS, I guess, is what Phil was referring to.
Yes,
right? There are four major programs over the past 7 years, right, that were canceled by the Secretary of Defense, right, who concluded, right, the analysis the Department of Defense has brought to me suggests that, look, this is not a viable path to go down.
Thank you. Leandra Bernstein with RIA Novosti. It was certainly a relief to hear a number of the panelists say that they don't support an acceleration of Phase 3 of the EPAA. But I would like to know the panelists' thoughts on how much of that program and the U.S. missile defense program in Europe is politically based and how much of it is actually security based, in particular with regards to the recent developments, President Obama asking for $1 billion for a European reassurance initiative, which would include moving U.S. naval ships into the Baltic and Black Seas, deploying them more regularly. So if the panelists could address that.
Maybe just one observation on EPAA. I think there is a fairly strong security foundation for going forward with that, and maybe part of the evidence is certainly in the fact that we eventually got all 28 members of NATO to endorse over the past sort of 3 or 4 years in terms of NATO ministerials. Support for EPAA, right? And beginning with, right, the way to think about EPAA is the most simplistic context is sort of, expanding concentric circles moving out from phase one through phase three in a manner in which we would expect, right, the threat to materialize coming out of the Middle East and Iran in particular, moving from short to medium, medium to intermediate range. And so to the extent that we can ever calibrate, you know, how capabilities and threats, you know, evolve, and that's always a difficult challenge. I think the EPAA is as reasonable a construct as any to try to match up with what would be the expected threat evolution in sort of ballistic missile threats coming out of Europe. So I think there's a fairly strong security-based foundation for at least that part of the question.
I'm Robert Gard with the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, a retired military. The statement was made that almost as an article of faith that, of course, we have to protect the United States and our population. No one could disagree with that. What bothers me is that studies I've seen have suggested that attacking the United States with a weapon of mass destruction with an ICBM is probably the least likely way that a rogue state would do so. No less than Donald Rumsfeld pointed out that it would be far more likely to attack the United States from a vessel 100 miles off the coast with a short-range missile or a cruise missile. It has a higher payload, more accurate, less expensive. So what are we doing about that threat?
Just comment, we don't have a defense against cruise missiles. We don't have the interceptors. We don't have the sensor network that we need. The Pentagon is exploring the question, but we don't have a defense against cruise missiles.
Well, that's really the basis of my question. Are we spending $40 billion to hedge against the least likely way that we're likely to get attacked by a weapon of mass destruction? The opportunity costs are terribly high in a period of such constrained defense budgets.
Just a short comment. One of my colleagues, who's a historian, he tends to call the ballistic missile defense system the new Maginot Line, worrying that we're, again, fighting the last threat. And this is why we personally really advocate for bringing the Missile Defense Agency, the Missile Defense Enterprise, sort of into the light and not being such an article of faith, article of almost religion, and that it ought to compete with other projects, you know, on its merits about what it can do to protect U.S. national security and what it can't do.
I just maybe offer counterposing comment. Sure, there are a range of threats we need to be and are concerned with regard to the homeland. And certainly post 9/11, right, greater emphasis on those things that might be coming into the country through different means. But, I mean, we have to at least recognize that countries are investing enormous resources into their ballistic missile activities. And we can sort of speculate a fair bit on what motivates them. Is it insecurity? Is it trying to deter some act? Are they trying to increase their own freedom of action to coerce their neighbors? But the fact is, countries continue to spend lots and lots of money on a wide range of ballistic missiles. And we see in particular two countries, North Korea and Iran, who by all measures, in terms of the investment in their space launch programs and the activity they have in solid and liquid propellants and multi-stage ballistic missiles, have a clear intent to acquire those kinds of capabilities. So the idea that, you know, we shouldn't be doing that, to me just is a non sequitur. We need to be addressing that ballistic missile threat. Should we be addressing sort of the challenges associated with cruise missile threats? That's a good question. I mean, I guess I'll paraphrase a little bit. Admiral Winnefeld, who I guess maybe it was last week at the Atlantic Council, said, look, the United States is sort of worried about that issue as well and has got activities and efforts underway to ensure that the United States, right, because timelines associated with cruise missile attacks could be much, much shorter. And so I would do nothing more than sort of at least echo his remarks that that's not an issue that the U.S. is ignoring at this point. But it doesn't mean we ought to be ignoring the substantial interest shown by many, many countries in acquiring ballistic missiles of ever-increasing capabilities. They understand the value of a ballistic missile. They understand its political value. They understand the coercive role it plays. They understand the role it plays during crisis, during conflict, and it certainly is driving that appetite.
Yeah, just a short follow-up. There's a fair bit of activity on air defenses and homeland defense against chemical, biological attack, covert attacks, et cetera. So it's not as though those other threats are being ignored. The question is do we have the balance right? Are we spending the right amount of money for biological defense as opposed to missile defense? And that's a tough question to answer. And I don't have the numbers for how much we're spending in these other areas. But as Pepe said, these states are spending a lot of effort trying to acquire missile capabilities, and there are some good reasons for it. And so clearly missile defense, both in the regional and the national context, is a legitimate enterprise. The question is, what's the right balance?
Tony Capasio with Bloomberg News. For Mr. DeBasio and Ms. Chaplin, can you try again on the question of if the test fails that's coming up shortly, how big of a setback is it to not only the public perception of the ground-based system but also the plans to go forward with the 14?
Look, I don't have much more to elaborate than what I said earlier, but I'll quote Admiral Searing on this. Well, actually, I'll quote my former boss, Jim Miller, who was supposed to be here, as well as Admiral Searing. And so back when the decision was announced in to go to the 14, back in March of 2013, Dr. Miller clearly made the points that, look, we're still in going to adhere to the fly before you buy principles that are articulated in the BMDR. Admiral Searing, now I guess in four times he's testified to Congress in the past couple of months, has said an increase in the number of GBIs in the fleet assumes a successful return to intercept of the CE2EKV. So it's a fairly, I think, clear statement by the senior officials that it's important to have a successful test before we sort of go on.
I would say it does depend on what the issue was. If it's a quality issue, it might not be as big of a setback as it is if it's a design issue. But it would take a long time to figure that out, and that would hold up production even longer, hopefully. It is a big setback. You could be spending a year or more, like they've already have, assessing what went wrong. But, again, that would depend on what exactly the cause was.
Mr. DeBasio, tell me that Sharpen, you said shortly. Is it going to be next?
Shortly.
Brian Beery, Washington correspondent, Europolitics. A question on the European system. I think it's more for Mr. DiBiasio. I understand that NATO now has it sort of under the umbrella of NATO, and NATO has given its political endorsement. But in the practical deployment of these systems in Poland, Romania, Spain, Turkey, how much is NATO, the NATO structure and management structures involved in that? And to what extent is it still just the United States working with the host countries, the Polish, Romanian governments, et cetera?
There's a set of institutions set up now within NATO that bring all of the NATO military authorities together. Part of it is under NATO's sort of military committee structure that actually now is involved in developing command and control procedures, right, for how missile defenses in NATO will be, particularly in an operational context, how they will be employed. For example, without going into too much detail, the procedures for, as I may have mentioned it earlier, for how we do something called transfer of authority, for example, when U.S. Aegis BMD ships are off conducting other missions under their sort of UCOM role, how those might be transferred to a SAC-UR role, which is a NATO command and control structure, right? Procedures for how that transfer of authority takes place have already been developed and implemented within NATO. Those are things associated with phase one. Transfer of authority applies to systems that might transition between two commands. In the case of those elements that are kind of single-focus, single-purpose missile defense elements for which they can be used for no other purpose, the Tipi-2 radar in Turkey, the Aegis ashore in Romania and later in Poland, those from the outset will be under, likely be under a SACUR sort of command structure, because there won't be issues of transfer of authority, right? The Aegis shore site in Poland won't be able to do other things, other missions, so it'll be there sort of 24/7 as a NATO capability. And so as those new capabilities are introduced, NATO will continue to work out these, you know, rules of engagement, command and control procedures, really as it's done as an alliance for 60 years. I mean, it won't be a terribly difficult challenge for them to do that, given that that's the way they've done things for the past 6.5 decades.
Thank you. Tom Kalina, Arms Control Association. Question for Mr. DiBiaso. I'm assuming that the Pentagon will not deploy the 14 additional interceptors unless the Pentagon is confident that they will be effective. Because, of course, regardless of the threat, if you're deploying, putting a defense that is not effective, not particularly helpful. But given what Phil said about the test record, 0 for 2, at best you'll be 1 for 3, how does the Pentagon generate that sense of confidence in the effectiveness based on the test record? Thank you.
Well, to be clear, the Secretary's made the decision to go forward with the 44, the GBIs. The question becomes, depending upon, right, how the subsequent tests turn out, I mean, there could be an impact on the timing of how those interceptors get deployed. The expectation is that if there's a successful test, that moving forward with the 44 GBIs, I believe by the end of 2017, remains the plan. Maybe back to Christina's comments, if it's not successful, I mean, there'll be a whole host of questions about, well, what went wrong and how long does it take to determine the sort of root cause of any particular problem. So I think we're going to have to wait until we get to that point in order to determine exactly what the impact might be on the timing of getting those additional 14, right, in silos as operational systems.
Just to follow up, my question is, if it is successful and you're 1 for 3, what is the basis of confidence that they will be effective? How are you confident, based on even if it hits, that the system will work?
I mean, I don't want to sort of punt and say this is a good question for Jim Searing, because it is, but I think, you know, between the CE-2 non-intercept test that took place this past January, combined with a successful CE-2 test soon, then Admiral Searing would certainly be the individual who sort of takes the recommendation forward to the Pentagon leadership and says, "Look, I'm confident that we've sort of reached the point where, this is a viable system." So the Secretary will get his advice from Admiral Searing, as he should, as the developer of these capabilities. He'll get his advice, right, from the other agencies within the Pentagon. There are a whole bunch of groups that sort of look at these things, the CAPE. Certainly NORTHCOM, the combatant commander, General Jacoby, as the warfighter who has to take control of these and operate these, is going to have sort of an input into that discussion. So I think it's fair to say there would be a process that involves sort of, you know, the analytic branches of the arm, the developer, as well as the warfighter, making their recommendations that say we're confident and we're going to go forward, or, you know, we want more time. I have no idea what the nature of the outcome of that discussion would be at this point.
I would just add to that, it's important to remember this isn't just the only test for the CE-2, there's a whole series of tests to fully prove out the capability that go into the early 2020s as planned. So we're still just sort of in the early stages of proving this thing out. There's more complexity that has to be introduced. There's more capabilities that have to be introduced. So you could be successful. There's still a lot of work ahead, and that's been one of our concerns, that this testing has not been done yet, and it won't be done for a fair period of time.
Just one extra footnote to this discussion. The confidence one has in a weapon system is not based solely on flight tests. There's a lot of ground testing, hardware-in-the-loop testing, subcomponent testing that is folded into the assessment of whether the system works. The one thing that's hard to test without a full flight test is the system integration, where all the parts come together, and sometimes there are interactions between parts that weren't anticipated. This is true for our ICBM or SLBM fleet. If you take one of the most successful missiles we have, the D-5, which has had a tremendous flight test record over its history, there were a relatively small number of tests, 10, 15, before that system went operational. And you don't calculate the reliability of the system just by taking the square root of N, you know, and saying, gee, was it a success or failure? It's a more complicated process.
On the discussion of ground testing, it's been identified that the GBI system has not gone through the ground testing that most interceptors of any type go through. So trying to add that reliability, and how do you, again, assess that confidence?
Since I mentioned the ground testing, I don't know how much ground testing has been done on GBI. But with these current CE-1, CE-2 variants, I would not expect to have high confidence. Whether it's sufficient for the political decision to go forward with the 14, that's somebody else's call. But it is not, has not proven to be the most highly reliable system, which is why I would strongly encourage us to go with the redesign program as soon as possible.
John Kappel from the Stimson Center. I was wondering if we could take this out a little longer term, maybe 10, 20 years, looking at missile defense as a technology. And my question is, in that longer term, assuming some of these testing and development issues are solved, how reliable will ballistic missile defense be? Are we looking at it having the possibility of having the 11 for 11 kind of record that we're confident we have a 90%+ chance of intercepting if there is a missile launch? Or is the sort of measure, countermeasure game or inherent technical challenges going to prevent missile defense, or especially ballistic missile defense, from ever reaching an extremely high level of confidence that we can intercept?
I'm not too good at predicting the future. Mid-course missile defense is the hardest thing we've ever tried to do. The Department of Defense have ever tried to do. It's really hard. And you see that in the test results. And I think the countermeasure question, and I don't just mean decoys now, will continue to be an important one. For example, radar jamming is becoming more and more a feature of modern warfare. And so you can ask the question, would North Korea or anybody else be so suicidal that they would attack the United States with no attempt to confuse the defenses or blind our radars or whatever, as, for example, blinding them with jamming first? So I think you're going to find that these issues don't go away.
And it's a very good question about where the long-term competition will head. I think there's no question that on the test range, we'll see these systems work fairly well, you know, whatever you want, 80, 90% success rate, sort of like SM3. SAD is 11 for 11, but no doubt that'll change before long. They'll probably have a failure somewhere along the line. But the more interesting question is, what's the outcome of the long-term measure-countermeasure competition? And that is, I think, a very difficult question to answer. There are lots of techniques to fool defenses, as I sort of alluded to earlier with that answer to the countermeasure question. There are a lot of techniques that the defense can harness to defeat countermeasures. It depends on how much money you're willing to spend. It depends on how well you understand each other's capability. And so I have thought about this question for the better part of a decade or so and have not come up with a simple answer for what the outcome of the long-term competition will be. I'll say one thing that, aside from the technology, I don't see anything in the technology arena that's a silver bullet out there, lasers, railguns, whatever. But the one issue I think that would be a game changer is if we can change the economics of defense. Because right now, defenses tend to be more expensive by, let's say, a factor of 5 to 10 than offensive missiles. And that is going to keep defenses in a rather limited role. We will always have thin defenses, limited defenses, and the like. Nothing, we won't have defense dominance, if you remember those kinds of strategies that were offered up 20 years ago or so. If we can change the cost exchange ratio between offense and defense, that will be a real game changer. Having said that, I don't know of any technologies that I am aware of that will make that change, at least not for large area defense like homeland defense of the United States. For terminal defense, point defense, defending an airfield, something like that, I can think of a number of things that would be game changers.
I'm Xiao Yan from Voice of America. I don't know whether anybody has asked the question. My question is, how advanced is China's hypersonic weapons? And whether the Congress appropriated $70 million for the hypersonic missiles, is this an appropriate level? Thank you. Oh, and also, sorry, one more question. Would any U.S. cities be threatened by that?
Yeah.
There are a number of countries, that the U.S. included, that are exploring hypersonic glide vehicles. It's not clear when these systems would become operational. I think you asked how fast they go. Well, they're hypersonic, so it's like Mach 5, Mach 7. It's pretty fast, 2-3 kilometers a second. If you can ever get a long-range hypersonic glide vehicle, you can attack whatever you choose to, whether it's a city, a military installation, whatnot. There are defenses that can handle these things as well, so one shouldn't forget that.
Okay, I think, I'm sorry, with apologies, I think we've gotten everybody who had the first question. For those of you who have second questions, the panelists may stick around for a few minutes, but it is 11:30 and we have to wrap up the panel at this point. So let me ask you to join me in thanking the panel for a conversation that I think covered a lot of good issues.